I promised some people that this would not be a heavy Hebrew class, so I decided to start out with something else instead. You can think of this as a quiz. I'll give you a couple of minutes.
You just somebody like to translate this for us into English. Bob Newman actually did it all in about 4 minutes. Anybody figure out any of them? While you're working on it, let me read you the history. The Nerd Bible started with my... I'm not writing this. Somebody else is writing this. Started with my sermon notes at Park Street Church in Boston when I was an MIT sophomore. Our college pastor used phrases like integrating faith into our lives and love should differentiate Christians from the world. Being intrinsically lazy, not to mention nerdly, I wrote those phrases down using calculus. And then when he got a postscript printer that could handle that sort of stuff, he decided to do some more verses with it. Anybody figure out any of them? Any math majors? Yeah, that's right. That there's one God over all the universe from everlasting to everlasting. Yep, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep, that's exactly right. He's never changing, independent of time and space. That's right. Mm-hmm. That was the second one. Yep. The third one? A little bit of set theory, maybe. Yes. All men are sinners and... Yeah, much less than God, greatly less, yes. How about the fourth? The fourth one is actually a pun. It's not a, it's not calculus. Christ is the Lamb the God. Okay, so. I didn't make these up, but. How about this one? John alluded to it in his prayer. Close. What's that doing? The cross, right? The cross of Jesus is victory over death. This one's pretty complex. I never studied calculus, but I never even heard of the stuff in here. I didn't hear much of this yet, except the zero God, the English part I recognize, but this one's pretty complex. That's a Fourier transform. Am I saying that correctly, Bob? Yes. It means Christ transforms us. And the life we live, we no longer live for ourselves, but for Christ. I'm not even going to use my laser pointer because I don't know where to point. Yeah, the Christian life part. Yeah, I got that part, yeah. This one's a little simpler. What's that? The D function. Close, yeah. Love is what differentiates Christians from the world. So differentiation. And then down here, it gets getting a little smaller, so I know it's hard to see from the back. That's a big list. Jew over Christ plus Greek over Christ, plus or minus circumcision over Christ, Scythian over Christ, plus barbarian over Christ, slave over Christ, free over Christ, equals zero, all within a set, equals zero. So with respect to Christ, this under here, there is no Jew or Greek, circumcision or uncircumcision, slave or free, Scythian or barbarian, right? How about this? Sanctification. Is doing what? Is integrating faith into life over time. Integrating faith into life over time. And then the one at the bottom is, I thought it was square love or something, but it's actually radical love. Those are out there on the web. I stumbled across them by accident, looking for something. I think I was reading an article on Pascal's wager and stumbled across that, so it's pretty interesting. What has he done? What has Dr. Prabhakaran done? He's translated the Bible for people who know calculus. But for people who don't know calculus, his translation is unintelligible, isn't it? Complete gibberish. In fact, some of you may even thought it was a joke when I put it up there. But actually, it is the gospel, of a sort, after a fashion, if you can read it. Well, when Bart asked me if I'd consider doing something for IBRI this spring, I've been teaching a course on Bible translation, and I've been teaching Greek or Hebrew for about 20 years here since 1984. And a couple of questions that come up, combined with this course that I'm teaching, suggested this topic. One of the questions, as soon as people hear that I teach languages, and I'm sure this happens for Bob and for any faculty member in a seminary, they say, oh, what's the best Bible translation? What translation should I buy? Well, I never answer that question. I smile and say, why do you want to get a new translation? And listen to what they say, and then maybe you can begin to answer it. The second question is something that comes fairly often along the lines of a note that I got from a friend via email a couple days ago, or last week, and the kind of question that comes up a fair bit, even after church. I was talking about this 2 weeks ago with someone. What does this verse really mean? Her note was, I'm curious as to what the actual translation of Psalm 37, 3b and 4 might be. New King James, NIV, and NASB are very different. Notice her question asks for the actual translation of the verses. And we'll look at those verses in a minute and see why she, or in a few minutes, and see why she asked that question.
Is there a clock?
Okay, thank you. I'm used to 3-hour classes, you know, so this is a, yes, you'll have to rein me in. But I do want to say up front that my goal is not to demonstrate the superiority of this translation, which I use, or try to prove that yours is wrong, your neighbor's is right, or even come up with a definitive theory of what it means to translate the Bible or how to evaluate Bible translations. Because although I'm going to use some examples, and if I pick on your version, I'm not picking on it because it's yours, I'm not picking on it even because it's necessarily bad or good overall. Certainly don't mean to imply that there aren't any good ones. There are lots of good ones. In fact, most of them are very good. But my goal is really a lot simpler than that. That's a pretty complex goal. My goal is really a lot simpler. I just want to ask and try to answer 3 questions. One is about language. One is about translation. The third one is about Bible translation. What is language and how does it work? What is translation? And granted that it occurs, how is it possible? And then, what determines why a particular translation of the Bible reads the way it does? How do Bible translations come about? Where do they come from? And why do they end up looking and sounding like they do? So, those 3 things. And if I will get to the last one, even if I have to skim over some of the intermediary steps, okay? First of all, when most people think of language, we probably think of language in terms of words. When you learn a language, anybody here study a language in college or high school or junior high, other than English, another language, or a language you can grow up with? Yes. So, one of the things that you probably remember is lists of vocab words and vocab quizzes, right? Learn these 10 words, bonjour, madame, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we tend to think of translation and language as a set of words. But in fact, language really doesn't work that way because language is not simply the process of compiling a group of words so that they mean something. I'd rather define language as a divine capacity, that is something that belongs to the nature of God himself, that is a divine capacity for communication within the Godhead, within the Trinity, that God has graciously shared with human beings. That is, he's given us the same ability to communicate that he has. And he's apparently shared that with other beings as well, like angels, although we don't know a whole lot about them. Beyond that, although you'll see, what do they call them? Or programs on television, PBS, etc., that talk about monkeys teaching monkeys to use sign language and that sort of thing. I think there's been a lot of good work that shows that really isn't language. It's more problem solving, but it's not what we'd call linguistic. That idea that language is an attribute of God That is, the capacity for linguistic communication is an attribute of God which is shared with us, then suggests that the point of language exists in order to foster communication so that we can communicate. And communication has many, many more phases than the words that we use. So, some linguists say, and this is an estimate, how do you actually measure this sort of thing, but the estimate is that as little as 20%, and maybe even less than 20%, of our communication is actually contained in the words that we use. The other 80, 85, 90% is stuff like setting, tone of voice, volume, rate, pitch, intonation, etc., etc., etc. All the intangible stuff. In fact, all the stuff that disappears once you put it in print. Unless you're one of those people who writes capital letters in your email to shout, you know, then I guess that conveys something more. And in fact, all linguistic experiences are translations. So that, and by that I mean, they all entail translation, because an idea exists in a person's mind, which is thought of in terms of words, which is then communicated either verbally or in writing to someone else. Probably not in exactly the same word that it was in their mind. The other person, the reader, the hearer, then has to take those words and make sense out of them. And so that person is trying to decode what the speaker or the author is trying to communicate. Each of those is a translation process. That is, taking something that is linguistic, something language, that's in language, and transforming it into another form. I don't mean oral versus writing. I mean translating it into another set of words. The only way you can get exact reproduction is to tape record it. And even there, you have the problem of static and squeal and pop and all that sort of stuff. And the tape breaking or the electricity running out. You know, if you think about, take a simple sentence like this, like, I love you. And think about how intonation and volume and pace and all those things change the meaning of the sentence. I love you. Or, I love you. Or, I love you. Or, I love you! we can begin to use the same three words, very simple sentence, and we can make it mean very, very different things, depending on how it's delivered. How much of the meaning is in the words? Well, there's certainly meaning in the words, but most of the meaning in the words comes out of the context. And in fact, if I happened to meet your eyes when I was just saying those things, I don't think anybody here was taking that personally. Right? And yet, if I say that and I'm looking at you, isn't it meant that way? Well, no, it's not. Because the setting, you see, the meaning that we import to the words comes out of the setting, and in the setting, you know that people say things that are said not for the content of the words themselves, but the words are being said to make some other point. Okay? Okay. So, we're all here. Okay. Second thing is, so language is for the purpose of communication. Second thing is, because language is communicative, it is a social activity. That is, it functions between the members of a community. It functions between communities, so that you can have representatives of different countries talking to each other, or the governor talking to the mayor, or that sort of thing, on behalf of the state, on behalf of the city. It functions even within the members of the community. So we talk to ourselves. And you say, wait a second, I'm not communicating with anybody. But you are communicating with someone, because you're using words that you've learned from other people. You're interacting most of the time with things that have happened in your life that have involved other people, with things that you've read, with things that you've seen or heard, so that even interior thought or interior speech is, in fact, an interactive, a communicative, and communal activity. Now, it doesn't do any other people a whole lot of good until something comes out of it. Admitted that, you know, it's pretty contained. But nonetheless, it is a community or a communal activity. Now, that then suggests that maybe words, those three or any others, don't have a whole lot of meaning by themselves. That words may not be the primary carriers of meaning at all, but that words get their meaning out of the circumstance in which they're used. And by circumstance, I mean everything that I talked about a minute ago. So, who I am, who you are, why we're here, where we are, what time of night it is, all that kind of stuff. Everything that goes into it, including where you went to school, how old you are, your socioeconomic background, your religious background, all that kind of stuff plays into it. Now, in fact, in our culture, it's pretty monolithic, thanks to mass media, and so we understand certain things without even thinking about them. We can take a conversation of four words, two lines, and the conversation can be completely intelligible. Okay? Would someone like to interpret that? Tell us, where does this happen? In the park? No. Where? In a house, right? Somewhere, or an apartment, or in a home, right? Who are Sue and Bob? Yeah, well, in today's culture, that maybe not be a safe question to ask. But in our setting, Sue and Bob are
a married couple.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Yes. What else do you know?
Doorbell rang.
And what else? Bob's in the tub. So they have electricity and running water, don't they? That means this didn't happen 150 years ago. Might mean it didn't even happen 75 years ago for most people. What else? Why does Sue go, doorbell? What's the purpose of, why is she saying, a doorbell, Bob, a doorbell. Isn't this great? We have a doorbell. Is that what she's doing? What's she doing? She wants him to get it. Bob, your turn, doorbell. And what's Bob's response? Why can't he do it? Yes. So you know something about Bob, something else about Bob and Sue and the culture in which they live. Modesty is a virtue in that society. You don't hop out of the tub and go running out to answer the door wrapped in a towel or less. You don't do it. Now, four words, and we could actually go on for a while. We're able to do that because we share a culture with those people. If the word for doorbell were farango and the word for tub were something, we wouldn't know what it was about. But because we share a whole, what linguists call a universe of discourse, we share a whole set, a huge set of expectations and understandings about the way life works, the way things run, the way our lives fit together, that enables us to make sense out of what, taken literally, is nonsense. You know, another example of that I thought of is that, generally speaking, it is not a good idea to go around saying, I love you, to other people's husbands and wives. I don't know if you ever noticed that, but that is not behavior that is bound to endear you to your spouse. And in fact, it's not just your spouse, but it's other people who may hear you saying that. I have a sister who's married, who's very beautiful, and she walked over here with me to school one day, and she... Actually, we walked our dogs over, and I had to come teach, and she was visiting us. So she walked over, and we kissed each other goodbye and said, I love you, and she was leaving. They were going back to Canada, so that was it. And I thought just today, I didn't think of it at the time, I thought, you know, if somebody didn't know who that was, and if they thought I was really, really stupid, they might think I was being unfaithful to my wife, publicly unfaithful. On the other hand, people who did know that she was my sister, and they might not have known she was my sister because she lives in Montreal, so we only see them once a year or so, or twice a year, so they wouldn't have known, had seen us, and we don't really look alike, do we? Oh, we do. Okay, my wife says we do. Well, I didn't. Okay, the face. Yes, if I got rid of my beard, we would. But somebody who knew that she was my sister probably wouldn't even notice what we said. So that context changes not simply the meaning, but even the impressions that we receive. The same event can be read in completely different ways. What if I told you that Sue and Bob were having marital problems? What if I told you Bob wasn't really in the tub? Ah, see? Suddenly the story changes, doesn't it? Because the world into which we put it has shifted a little bit, and so the meaning of the words and even the meaning of the expressions themselves change. Now, what goes on when we read, and because we're talking about translation and Bible translation, primarily we're talking about reading. As we read, or listen to someone, we constantly are anticipating what they're going to say next. That's because our brains work a lot faster than somebody else's mouth can. And a lot faster than words can come across the page. We project what we think they're going to say, we project what we think is going to happen, and then when something does happen, it either fits our projection, in which case our interpretation of the events is confirmed, or it doesn't fit, something unexpected happens, or somebody says not what we expected them to, and so we have to shift our interpretation of what's already been said. So that reading, or conversing or listening, really looks like this. And sometimes we go all the way back here and reinterpret, and we're constantly re-examining what we've been hearing. Now, for some of you, that's already happened tonight. This is not what you thought it was going to be. You thought this was going to be, okay, Hebrew Bible's open, Jonah 1:1, we're going to go through the book, and this is what it means, and here's the answer. And this is why. That's not it. And so already, having to reinterpret what's happening, what's being said, in light of your expectations. In fact, usually the reason that a speaker or a book is dull or boring is they always say exactly what we think they're going to. And so there's no interest level. It's like, oh boy. Okay, if that's sentence 2, then I know sentence 5. So I can take a nap till sentence 6, just in case he changes. You know, like the kids who say, oh, I know this. This is lecture 274. Remember that? Here's an example of that. This is a story. I'm going to uncover it just a sentence at a time. And, there's a typo in the first sentence, so it won't make a whole lot of sense. It's supposed to be his way. So John was on his way to school last Friday. Tell me something about John. Anybody tell me something about John? Okay. He was really worried about the math lesson. Now what do you think? Yeah, it could be a math teacher. He's not qualified. Yeah, that's right. It was unfair of the math teacher to leave him in charge. Now who is he? After all, it's not a normal part of the beginning of the students. So we read along, and we have to fix what we read. Now, you knew I was setting you up. The Bible doesn't quite do that, and in fact, this is an aside, so this is just for free, not part of the topic. One of the biggest problems we have in reading the Bible is that we know it so well, we don't read it. We look at it, and we let the words go past our eyes, but it's very, very hard to actually read the Bible. To read Jonah wondering, is he going to drown? The way the first guy who heard it would have wondered. That addresses a question that I'll come to you in a little bit. Well, when we talk about language then, we say its purpose is communication, and it is a social activity. It's an activity that functions within social settings, even if it's a society of one person. And because of the nature of language as communication, that is communicating ideas from a mind to a mind, or to minds, it always involves some sort of translation. There's a commentary on Proverbs that I had to use when I was writing my own commentary on Proverbs. It was published, it was written in German in 1869, well, started in 1869, finished in 1872. It was written by Franz Delitzsch. It's a very, very good good commentary. And I'm very thankful that a long time ago it was translated into English, because my 19th century German is non-existent. Well, not very good. Now, think about a pastor who decides to preach a sermon on Proverbs, and he turns to Franz Delitzsch's commentary for help with the Hebrew text. Okay, you got that? So here's a verse in Proverbs in Hebrew, and he picks up Delitzsch's commentary. Now, what he's reading is a 1950s translation of 1870s German that is itself an interpretation of 1000 BC Hebrew. Now, more than that, let's say that this particular pastor was very studious and actually studied German in high school and college well enough that he still knows it, can read it. And he says, well, you know, this is very helpful. I think this translator's made some mistakes because this doesn't make sense. I'm going to read the original German commentary. So he manages to track down an original edition, first edition of Delitzsch, Delitzsch, and starts reading it. Now what has he done? Here's a pastor living at the beginning of the 21st century who learned German from textbooks that were written at the end of the 20th century by people who themselves lived at the end of the 20th century in North America, not in Germany, who themselves had learned German from someone else as a second or third language. And he's using that German to try to understand German from a century and a quarter earlier, and to understand that German's representation of Hebrew from almost 3,000 years ago. Isn't translation an interesting question? And we haven't even got to the good part. Why is he doing all that? Because he's now going to take that same proverb and explain it to a bunch of people who don't know Hebrew or German. Well, you're probably wondering what this is doing here. I'm going to try to not make a fool out of myself. It may not be altogether easy. Tell me if this blows anything up, okay? This is a little piece by Johann Sebastian Bach. Now, that's Bach's Prelude in C major from the book called The Well-Tempered Clavier. Well, it wasn't really Bach's Prelude in C major. That was my hash of it. The point is, when we think about linguistic activities as involving translation, it may be easier if we think about, if we substitute the word musical for linguistic. Think about this. After Beethoven was deaf, he continued to write music. Where did the music come from? It wasn't music that he heard, because he was deaf. So it came from somewhere inside his heart, his head. He then transcribed that onto paper. And that was then transcribed by a publisher. If you've ever seen a composer's manuscript before the days of MIDI keyboards, when you typed into the computer and they printed it out beautifully, there, really, I can't imagine, really do not understand how anyone could have read the music. After it was transcribed, it was performed, it's performed by musicians. Every musician who performs any piece, that piece included, performs it in a slightly different way. Think about this. The reason that I chose that particular voice, one nice thing about these is that you have, is that you have a harpsichord, which of course is Bach's a rote chord. But how does it sound if I use a vibraphone? Doesn't sound quite the same, does it? Why not? Well, is there something intrinsically wrong with that? No. I mean, think of Switch-On Bach, which came out when the Moog synthesizers were invented back in the 1960s. Or think about the, who are they, the Scooby-Doo singers who used to sing Bach to, well, not Scooby-Doo, but you know what I mean. They used to sing Bach on syllables. So every musician takes the same piece of music, written down, it looks exactly the same on the paper, black and white, dots and lines, and it sounds different. In fact, the same musician plays the piece on two different nights and it sounds different. Because every step of that process, from composer's conception to performance, involves a translation of an idea from one form to another. Now, to go back to writing or to language, a speaker-writer takes that thought, puts it out there, and then basically has no more control. If you've ever spoken in public or given a presentation to a group, it's very interesting. The comments that people make afterward are very interesting. They'll say, "I'm so glad you said this, and I don't remember ever saying it." And sometimes I've had people say, "Oh, that was so meaningful because you said, and what they said I said is the opposite of what I was trying to say." And then I immediately want to grab them and say, no, I didn't say that. But you see, what actually happens is, somewhere, either in my presentation or in their interpretation, their translation of it, what they heard is what I said, as far as they're concerned. So, it's not the message they thought they heard. It's what they really heard. And furthermore, and I don't want to press the metaphor too far, just as no performance of music is ever definitive, so Glenn Gould's recording of the Goldberg Variations came out in, what, 1967 or 68, something like that, and kind of blew the musical world away. He played them fast and furious like nobody had ever played them before. And everybody said, "Oh, this is it. This is Bach the way, you know." Well, now, 30 years later, people are still recording the Goldberg Variations. Why are they doing that? If that was the definitive recording, why keep on putting out new ones? Because more people want to keep performing it. Of course, you make money if you record, so there's a motivation there too. But more people think they have the right way to perform the piece. So new translations, new interpretations come out constantly because setting changes. Maybe somebody finds out, "Hey, you know, Bach didn't write that for a harpsichord. He really wrote it for the something else, for a guitar, or for something else." So we run into just as in music, so in Bible translation, we run into this huge stream of stuff that keeps coming out. From the time that the Revised Standard Version came out in 1952 until the new Revised Standard Version came out, which was 1986, I think, there were 27 new translations in English of the whole Bible, and 25 new translations of the New Testament that were not part of those 27 whole Bibles. That's a lot of Bibles. And they keep coming out. In fact, I just got a flyer a couple of days ago for a new one that's coming out from the Holman Christian Bible translation. Holman Publishing is going to do their own translation. And we keep coming out with new translations, because we can't ever be sure that we have it exact. This is a book called The Poetics of Translation, History, Theory, Practice, that we're reading in the course that I'm teaching. And in here he says, has a couple of interesting statements. He says, first of all, he says that translation is the activity of creating metaphor. A metaphor is to say, this is like that. So we take a piece of music and I play it on the keyboard and I say, now what you just heard is like what's there on the music. Like it, it's not exactly it, but it's like it in some way. We translate a passage of scripture or a novel or translate anything else, and what we've come up with is something pretty close to, but not exactly the same. In fact, Barnstone goes on and says, perfect replication is, of course, possible only when there is no change. Okay? Does that make sense? Perfect replication is possible only when there is no change, when there is simply repetition, there that is A equals A. Now you've got it. Now you know exactly what A is. It's A. Let me give you an example. So in the course on poets, we translate Psalm 1, and we talk about what it means and spend some time. Everybody knows Psalm 1? Well, we finally have done this, and this is true. What I'm going to tell you is not a boast. It's simply a fact. We have a translation of Psalm 1 that perfectly captures the Hebrew text. If you want perfect equivalence, that's it. That's as close as you can get. I could even read it to you. I'm not so sure that would be very helpful. And maybe those of you who have memorized it would tell me that I wasn't really reading Psalm 1 at all, but it was talking in some other tongue. But you see, Barnstone is right. You can only perfectly transcribe something if you reproduce it, if you use a photocopier or a laser printer and run off 10 copies. That then raises a question about how Bible translation works. Because usually, here's a blurb, publisher's blurb from Thomas Nelson on the, well, it's really an apologetic for the New King James Version. The title is Complete Equivalence in Bible Translation. Notice, not approximate equivalence, not getting close as we can, but complete equivalence in Bible translation. And he goes on, he says, this is how Dr. Price starts. A translation is no better than the theory on which it is based. And then he goes on a little bit later and he says, the response of alternate translation theories, that is, you've got this problem of that we'll talk about literal and paraphrastic and that sort of thing, has been to abandon the attempt to reflect the structure of Hebrew or Greek. Instead, their goal has been to produce equivalence of thought between the two languages, emphasizing naturalness, clarity, readability, the natural idiom of the second. In other words, make English sound as much like, the Bible sound as much like English as possible. It doesn't sound like Hebrew or Greek. Then he says, in fact, complete equivalence, though a recent theory, preserves principles of translation used intuitively by the master translators of much earlier generations. And then this is his definition. And this comes from the foreword of the New King James Version. The theory, quote, seeks to preserve all of the information in the text while presenting it in good literary form. All information in the text refers not only to the information derived from the meanings of words used, but also to structural information. Information contained in the structure of phrases, clauses, discourse. Once this information is transferred to the second language, it's restructured to an acceptable form that communicates with the reader. The result is a faithful literary translation in good literary idiom. Preserving all the information in the text. The difficulty is, as we've already seen two examples of, all the information isn't in the text. Now, in the case of the Bible, there's nobody we can go to talk to. There are no native speakers of biblical Hebrew. Modern Hebrew is not the same language. It's much more like, it's much more of an Indo-European language in the way that it's put together than Biblical Hebrew, which is a Semitic language, very different. So we don't have anybody we can talk to. There are people who speak modern Greek. Greek's been spoken continuously, but modern Greek is very different than Biblical Greek, as I found out when I picked up a book and thought, oh, I've studied Greek, and opened it up and thought, I haven't studied Greek. At least I haven't studied this Greek. So, what are we aiming at? And how do we know when we've hit it? Well, this is a blurb that came out. And by the way, blurb is, that's the word the industry uses, okay? That's not a derogatory term. That's what publishers themselves call them, blurbs. Here is a blurb for the New International Version, NIV, that was published when it came out and was distributed widely and available free, and so people could pick it up and then be enticed and encouraged to buy the version. It says this. He says, the NIV is a new translation made directly from the original Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek languages into today's English. It is not restricted by the grammar and vocabulary of the older versions. Question, is the NIV an accurate translation? An accurate translation. Answer, yes. Accuracy was one of the main goals of the NIV translators. There is a need for a Bible that is dependable and faithful to the original languages without being stiff, unnatural, or hard to read. And then they go on and discuss their theory of translation, which is what's come to be known as functional or dynamic equivalence, and I'll talk about that, address that question in a few minutes. One of the things that Barnstone addresses in this book on the Poetics of Translation is the relationship between the author, the translator, the text, and the audience. If author, translator, text in between them, and an audience out here for whom the text is being translated. Of course, there's another audience that read it in the original, but we'll set them aside. We'll set them aside for a moment. And he suggests that what actually happens in translation is that the translator becomes a co-creator or a co-author alongside the original author, because the translator interprets what that author is saying, interprets it, has to understand it himself or herself, and then has to write it in such a way that it makes sense for people who can't read what the original author said. So his suggestion, of course, is you should never say Iliad by Homer, and then on the fourth four pages in, translated by Thomas Latimer. It should be Iliad by Homer and Latimer. And he's actually right. It's very interesting then to see that some Bible translations will not publish the names of the people who work on the committee, who work on the translation. Others do, but some don't. And it raises a question of that he gets at, will come to, of the identification of what is the Bible and how we identify and how we think about it relative to the translations that we have. Well, so why do we have all these translations coming out? Just like we have all these musical performances, new CDs of Goldberg and other pieces as well. Well, there are some good reasons, I think. I meant to bring a book and forgot that talks about the Holman Bible translation. It's another publisher's blurb. And basically the editor for Holman says, oh, here it is, says, why another Bible translation? Do we really need one? And he says, this is the publisher, if God put it in the hearts of some people to initiate a new translation, they ought to obey him. And then he goes on and says, I think there's a significant unmet need that the HCSB, the Holman Christian Study Bible, will address. And he doesn't really explain what that unmet need is, but you don't expect him to in a six-page blurb. There really are, I think, for publishers and for individuals who start off this process, they think there's something wrong with the translations we have. We need to do something different. That's one thing. They're a little too stiff or too informal or formal or something like that. A second thing is, some publishers have said there are groups that are simply not served by this particular translation. It's too patriarchal, for example. So that every time you can possibly put the word he in there, all the translations out there do it. When there are a lot of times when they could say someone or anyone or whoever or something like that. And I know a lot of people that this offends, so we're going to start a new translation that's not going to use that kind of language except when it has to. And the text really, and the circumstance really requires it. Or, for groups, there are translations that are specifically geared. There's a basic Bible, the Bible in basic English, which has an entire vocabulary of 800 words. That's for people who have come to this country or some country, learned English as their second language, and barely can read English, but you want them to have the Bible in English, and so they can read that. It's interesting to read. I don't commend it if you can read well, but it's very interesting. It's very interesting. And then thirdly, a big motivation is there's a lot of money in Bible translation. There's a huge amount of money. The publishers will recoup their investments. And some of them, like the NIV and the New American Standard and the New Living Translation, will recoup it many, many, many times over. So there are lots of motivations for multiplying translations. But how do they go about doing it? Well, it works like this. Actually, this section is called, in my mind, I'm calling this constraints on translation. That is, what makes our translations turn out the way they do? Don't worry, we're going to look at some real texts. Don't worry, we'll do that. I won't let the evening pass without putting some Hebrew up on the board, on the overhead for you. But how do they do it? One of the constraints is that you might think, boy, you know, think of William Tyndale. He sat down and he had his Bible and he just ripped away and wrote it in English and then they published it and that was it. Wasn't that great? Well, that day is pretty much over. I mean, people still do that, but they don't get published. Instead, what happens, I've looked through probably half a dozen of these kinds of, like this is for the New and Revised Standard Version, apologetics for how they went about doing it. All of them have five to maybe 8 or 10 steps between the person who actually sits there with his Hebrew Bible or her Greek Bible or whatever and the final product. And it usually looks something like this. This is the New King James Version. They assigned scholars to particular books, and each scholar suggested ways that the King James should be revised according to their guidelines, going along with their guidelines. So it's not really a translation, it's a revision of. Okay, that's what all those news are, by the way. NASB is a revision of the ASV of, what, 1901, I think, something like that? And the New King James, revision of King James, New Revised, revision of Revised Standard, they're all basically looking at the first one that was done and saying, well, what do we think of this now? What should be changed? New Living Translation, same thing. It's the Living Bible basically transmogrified into a slightly higher level. So each scholar gets a book. Each one then suggests revisions to the King James, to the executive editor for the, obviously, the Old Testament, but there was an executive editor for the Old Testament, one for the New Testament. The executive editors reviewed those changes, suggested further changes, and then wrote in all the changes and submitted the book to an English editor. The English editor checked all that suggestion for grammatical accuracy, literary beauty, effective communication. That's his responsibility. Then, while that was going on, the whole time, at the same time, there's review by two national oversight committees, one in Britain, one in North America, which included clergy, lay people, as well as people involved in the publisher, with the publisher itself. The executive editors for the Old and New Testament, they sent the proposed text to the executive review committee. So you've got a translator, executive editor, executive review committee, and lay oversight committee. The members of those committees read through the whole manuscript for each book and made their own list of changes that they thought should be incorporated into it. Before the committee came together, they did that on their own. Those changes were then collated into the manuscript by the executive editors. Then the committee for the entire executive review committee looked over the whole thing. They went through the whole book. They said they never did more than 5 verses in an hour. I can tell you, 5 verses an hour is pretty fast for this kind of work. And at each stage, all these people, except the clergy and lay advisors that were part of the fifth step, are referring constantly, they say, to the Greek and Hebrew texts. And frankly, that's the standard. I found I got in the mail a blurb from a person. Oh, yes, here it is. It's called Confessions of an English Stylist. Of the 80-plus people at work on the Holman Christian Standard Bible, I am one of only a handful who can't read Greek or Hebrew. If I could, I might never get any work done. My job as an English stylist is to make sure that something from a translator in England through an editor in Chicago is consistent with another section from California that was edited in Texas. So by the time a translation text gets to me, scholars and language specialists have hammered out hundreds of decisions about meaning, nuance, syntax, grammar, but that still leaves personal variations in word choice, sentence structure, application of the project translation guidelines. Now, one of the goals, and you've probably noticed this if you read through your Bible in, say, a year or so, is no matter what Bible, if you're using a modern translation, it pretty much all sounds the same. The sentences are all the same length, the vocabulary is about the same, reading level of difficulty, it's all about the same. That's not the way the Hebrew and Greek texts are at all. I mean, certain authors use long sentences, some people are using very rare words, other people, it's almost like reading the Sunday newspaper, you can just pick it up and kind of read it. But one of the determinations is that in order to present the Bible as a book, that is, a book, it's going to all sound the same. And so you get the stylists at the top, sort of, pretty close to the top, who basically say, no, we can't say it this way here in Exodus because over in Galatians it says it this way. Not even that Galatians is quoting Exodus, just that the way the sentences sound all has to be consistent through the whole thing. So, when you combine that with the goal of making everything readable at about a seventh grade level, which is what most of them are aimed at, anywhere from fifth to seventh grade, you can see that, my goodness, it really does have a, when they say they're working from the original text, that's really a problem, because the translator maybe, I mean, Dr. Vinoy, who worked on the New Living Translation for Samuel and Kings, I think, certainly was, but his work is buried about 7 or 8 levels below the translation that you actually see. The other part of it, another constraint on translation is tradition. I mean, how can you change something in the Bible? Psalm 23 has to sound like Psalm 23. The Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6 has to sound like the Lord's Prayer. You can't come up with something too new, or no church will use it. And you want churches to use it, you want pastors to use it, because then that will encourage people in the pew to use it, which means more people will buy your Bible. So tradition, the weight of that, hangs very heavy. In fact, I was reading something that said, might have been in Barnstem, Becky might remember, she's in that class too, but somewhere in there he said that the estimates are that 80% of any 20th century Bible, he's including New Revised Standard, NIV, is the same as William Tyndale. Word for word. Now, the spelling's been changed, of course, but word for word the same. About 80%. So when they say, oh, this translation is made from the original text, well, no. Or maybe. I mean, they're looking at the original text. But what they've got is this big pack on their shoulder of weight that's called tradition that says, do it this way. And even if they didn't have that, everybody who works on a Bible translation has already read the Bible in translation. And so they know what the story is supposed to sound like. They know how Jonah turns out, that they know that David is going to become king after all. They know what it all, and the whole time, in order to get to that level, you've got to teach in a seminary, you know, for 20 years or so. So by the time you get there, you've been reading articles, commentaries, teaching on it, reading papers on it, going back. And so all that plays into your original translation. And so if modern Bibles tend to sound the same, there's no surprise. It's almost impossible to imagine that they would sound radically different. Now, when they do sound radically different, though, then the question comes, as my friend asked, well, these three verses, or these four versions of this psalm, seem not to say the same thing at all. And I'll look at that in just a minute. Another constraint, of course, is theology, and I'm not going to talk about that for very long, although it is interesting that you get phrases like in the Markan account of the Lord's Supper, when Jesus says, the word new is not, Jesus says, you know, this is the new covenant in my blood. There's no new there. That was added by, who added that? I think William Tyndale added that, actually. And it's been in there ever since. And it's just, this is the covenant in my blood. And so, and the suggestion of, on some parts is that that is a, the translation is motivated by a desire to tie the Lord's Supper directly to Jeremiah 31, which then goes over to Hebrews, right? So now you can connect Hebrews with, so you can pull the whole, and then back to Passover and the Tabernacle. So the whole thing gets pulled together very neatly, just by putting a little word new in. And what harm is there if after all this stuff is true anyway, we'll just put it in? Well, as I said a minute ago, the translator is kind of stuck between the author, the audience, the form, the message, and all those sorts of things. I'm going to look at two more factors in constraint, and then look at some specific examples to try to show you, try to illustrate some of the things that I'm talking about. And I do know what time it is. One of the things that happens as authors, actually, as translators kind of disappear, and as authors are unknown. That is, not that we don't know who wrote Joshua, but we've never met him. Even if we did know him, we've never met him. And Moses hasn't been around for a long, long time. And so the feeling of responsibility to the human author in Bible translation is pretty minimal. The feeling of responsibility to the divine author is usually much bigger. The responsibility is before God to work for him. Well, what ends up happening then is that we tend to, unlike people in other religious traditions, we tend to pick up this and say, the Bible says, whereas if we were Muslim, we wouldn't say the Quran says, unless we were actually reading it in Arabic. If we were Jews, we would not say the Bible says, Tanakh says, unless we were reading it in Hebrew. We'd say the Jewish Publication Society New Version says, right? The New American Standard Version of the Bible says. The New International Version. You see the difference? So that what happens, and there's a fascinating article in a collection of essays, fascinating, that shows that this happened even with the Septuagint. When the Bible was translated into, the Old Testament was translated into Greek in about the 3rd century B.C., you can see a tradition of references to it whereby about the 5th century A.D., about 500 years after Christ, the Septuagint, or actually 300 years after Christ, the Septuagint, the Greek Bible, has replaced the Hebrew Bible that it translated and is now the real Bible, to the extent that when Jerome started translating the Bible, the Vulgate, trying to use Hebrew, Augustine, attacked him and said, "You can't do that." And when Jerome's translation was read, because he took it out of the Hebrew text instead of the Greek, there were riots in the streets. Imagine that today. People were so upset that he'd used the Hebrew text. Because the translation, the Septuagint, had supplanted the original entirely. And we kind of smile at that, but that really is what we do. I just say it, you know, that's the way we think about it. Which raises a big question about our understanding of the relationship between this text and this text, that is, an English and a Hebrew, an English and a Greek somewhere, text. How do we see that relationship? And which is also why translators constantly harp on the idea. In fact, every single blurb has the word accuracy in it. And almost all of them have faithfulness or faithful. This is an accurate and faithful translation. An accurate and faithful representation. So that the translation becomes the goal and replaces the original. And in fact, you can see that quite strongly in some groups. I remember the Jehovah's Witnesses came to our door and they said, well, you know, in the Greek, it's, oh, I said, oh, wait a second, let me get my Greek New Testament. And I ran downstairs, got my Greek New Testament, brought it up, and they said, yeah, right here in John 1, it says, a God. And I said, oh, that's interesting. They said, there's no article there, is it? No, there's no article there. I said, but look, 3 verses down, your translation has God with a capital G, and there's no article there. And the verse after that, it has God with a capital G, there's no article there either. And at the end, they said, well, let's go look at someplace else. See, their translation is the original. Of course, in their mind, my reading of the Greek text is horribly compromised because I'm a Christian. You know, I believe that there's a Trinity, so I couldn't possibly be right. Well, I started out by saying that language doesn't consist simply of words. I'm afraid that most of the time when we think about Bible translation or even what the Bible really means, what we mean is, did they get the words right? And are the words right? I'm just going to say something very quickly about that. And it's this. Words exist on a continuum from words that are very narrow and specific, what we might call technical terms. So if any of you have studied sciences or even specialized highly in any field, you know that there are terms that you use that nobody outside your field would understand and that have only one meaning. So every time you use that word, it means one and only one thing. I was going to use the word pneumonia, looked it up in the dictionary, and discovered there are about 20 of those. So that wasn't very helpful. So instead I found something else in botany, and then I discovered that it actually had two meanings. So it's kind of, but podophyllin, what is podophyllin? Well, I discovered that that is a bitter purgative resin extracted from the rootstock of the May apple. Well, it doesn't mean anything else. So every time you use the word podophyllin, every time you use it, that's what it means. Okay? Now, how about if we go back to our earlier example and talk about the word love? Well, that's one of these words that is, now don't misunderstand me, it's very shallow and very broad because we use it to mean all sorts of things. I love the Red Sox. I love this weather. I love ice cream. I love that show. I love your car. I love your hair. I love you. Right? All sorts of things. It gets its meaning from the way it's used. So podophyllin brings all of its meaning into its context. It always means the same thing. Every time it's used, it never means anything else. So no matter how you're using it or what context it appears in, it always refers to that bitter extract from the root of the May apple. Okay? The word love depends tremendously on its context for its meaning. And without the context, you almost don't know what it means at all. Now, here's what's most tricky. Two or three languages. Big, wide word over here. Over in this language, no big, wide word. Two little words. And maybe even a fourth one that kind of overlaps with one of those. Which one do you use? Which one is most accurate? Especially when you think of this. Total vocabulary, Biblical Hebrew, 8,200, maybe 8,400 words. 8,400 words. Total vocabulary, Greek New Testament, 5,000 something words. From the horse's mouth. That's it. Total vocabulary used by William Shakespeare to write his plays and sonnets, 30 to 32,000. Total vocabulary in the English language according to Oxford English Dictionary, 500,000. So you have a total biblical vocabulary of roughly 14,000 words. 14,000. Less than half of the words that Shakespeare used in his play. Less than half. We don't even have a clue. I hope this isn't scaring you too much. I'm trying to scare you, but not too much. We don't even have a clue as to how those words were used outside the Bible. For example, this. Where in the Bible could you turn, if let's say you were studying Hebrew, and you wanted to do something cute. So you decided to go to a friend and say, in Hebrew, or Greek, you could use Greek too. You decided to go to a friend and say, hey, let's go down to Mom's and get some water ice. And you decided to say that in Hebrew. How would you do it? You can't do it, folks. The words aren't there. Could they say, let's go to Mom's and get some water? Well, they couldn't have said that because they didn't have water ice in those days. But could Abraham have said to Sarah, oh, Sarah, I ripped my favorite robe. Could you repair it? Could you fix it? Sell it for me? We would assume that he could say something like that. Or if she asked him how he wanted his eggs, he could say over easy or something like that. Or some way to talk. But we don't know. Because all we've got is a little tiny piece of biblical language and a little tiny piece of biblical culture. And occasionally archaeology gives us a little, lets us open the window just a crack. Say, oh yeah, look, there's some light. We never knew that was down there. Now, that doesn't mean, I mean, some of you are probably wondering, have I painted myself into a corner? Here's the really amazing thing. Because language is innate to human beings, it's part of who we are and the way we're made, translation is possible. We can translate things. We can understand each other. You can understand me. You'll ask me questions. I can understand you. In fact, you can talk to somebody who barely knows English, and you can help them find where they're trying to go. Usually. Translation really does happen. But it happens not because translators are omniscient or have some secret insight or hidden ability. It happens because God's made us to communicate, and that communication is not going to be disrupted, by the mere vagaries of different linguistic communities. Now, let me look at a couple of examples, and then I'll stop, okay? Here are a couple of examples. When you look at different translations, you'll find out that they say things in various ways. One of those ways that you notice in the Old Testament, I just saw an editorial about this in Christianity Today, is what happened to the word "and" at the beginning of every verse in the Old Testament? And this man was saying, there's no, I want the "ands" back. I want to say, "and this happened." And he was really serious, very obviously very upset. Well, where does that come from? It comes from a little conjunction in Hebrew, very little letter. And if you look at this, you see that what he's describing is in fact true. These are not quite, I meant to get these in chronological order, but I didn't quite do it. My chart got messed up. But you can see that there's quite a difference between beginning every verse, and I won't, well, I'll just turn to the, so you know what's going on here. Sorry, it's Numbers, if you have a Bible, Numbers 17. This is the story of Aaron's rod that budded. So he says, in the King James, and Moses spoke to the sons of Israel, and all their leaders gave him a rod apiece for each leader. And Moses, verse 7, deposited the rod before the Lord. Verse 8, and on the next day Moses went into the tent. Verse 9, and Moses brought out all the rods. Verse 10, and the Lord said to Moses. Verse 11, and Moses did just as the Lord had commanded. And the sons of Israel spoke to Moses. Well, you look at the other translations, and you notice that the conjunctions they use are a lot different. It's one Hebrew, it's not even a word, it's a piece of a word. It doesn't even exist as a word by itself. They just stick it on the front of another word when they want to say, and, thus, so, therefore, then, all those sorts of things. That grows out of the translation philosophy of the edition that you're reading. That decision. The decision is, we're not going to just put ands in there. We're going to make it sound like English, because and is not English. That's not how we talk. Or how we write. It's how we talk, maybe, but it's not how we write. Here's another example. How about that little thing that, again, I've heard people lament. It doesn't say, and it came to pass anymore. What happened to that? Why? I mean, I've actually heard sermons on it came to pass. Well, what that's actually reflecting, and those are just two verses in Joshua 5, what those are actually reflecting is a little verb, looks like this. And when you look at this word in the context of a story, it actually functions like a signal to say, we change scenes. We're on to something new. Next paragraph, next section. This is, okay? We're going around the corner here, folks. If you look at the book of Jonah, which we won't because I talked too much earlier, you'd see that those five locations in Jonah where this form occurs, in each case, those words, that word, functions to say, this is what happens next. The one in 1:1 and 3:1, The word of the Lord came to Jonah ben Amittai saying, and saying a second time, saying, in 3:1, breaks the book in half. They're repeated. The ones in 1:4, in 1:4 and 2:1, again, are pretty much the same. Although it's a little difficult to see in without Hebrew, you can see that you have, there was this on or in, and that's the same thing in both cases. See this little letter here, in, those two go together as well. There's the subject, the verb, vayhi, the subject, and the place where, or in this time, the place in the fish. And then this one down here is different from all those. It doesn't sound like them at all. See, there's no subject. There's no indirect object. There's no preposition. There's just a time thing when the sun came up. Now, if you write that down and go back and study the book of Jonah, you'll see that those introduce the five main movements of the book of Jonah. I have one of the students in Bible translation said he was reading through Genesis in Hebrew looking for this word. He said there are 30 or 40 of them in Genesis 1, and then you sort of get a few, and then you get to Genesis 39, and there are another 25 or 30. So in two chapters of Genesis, almost a third of all of them that occur in the book of Genesis happened, just in that little tiny space, which means the rest of them are scattered over. So then the question is, what's going on? It's not just it came to pass, but it's a signal that says, hey, look at this. Pay attention here. The kind of thing that in English we might do with italics or big red letters or something like that. Or if this were a PowerPoint presentation with flying words and sound effects. That's one kind of question that translators wrestle with. And basically, the assumption of modern translations is that doesn't need to be represented at all. The difficulty is they just leave it out. And very rarely try to figure out some way in English to show, okay, we've reached a new thing, a new stage of the story. Here's an example of a word. This is probably too small to read. I couldn't get it all on the page. But the word is usually translated evil or wicked. I'm taking examples from Jonah because that's what we're working on in our class. The word is usually translated. In fact, if you take Hebrew next fall, which will be, by the way, from 4:30 to 7:15, Monday and Thursday, in room 27, starting the Thursday after Labor Day, you'll find that this word means, according to the vocab list, bad, evil, or wicked. That's what they all say. But look what's bad, evil, or wicked in the book of Jonah. Nineveh, their wickedness, it's a noun. The storm, the sailors use it to refer to the storm. They say, this, what is it, disaster? This wicked, well, storms aren't wicked. I mean, wicked means you do bad things, right? His evil way, that's a pretty good one. This is where the king of Nineveh is saying, let everyone turn from his evil way, and God saw that they all turned from their evil way. That seems pretty straightforward. And this is God himself turning back from the evil that he said he was going to do. That is the disaster he was going to bring on Nineveh. So it sort of goes along with the disaster idea of the storm up here. Here, this is very interesting. There's the verb of the same noun. You can see those two letters there? They're the same as the two middle letters up here. It was evil to Jonah, very great evil. We don't even know what the it was. Maybe to Nineveh's repentance. Maybe he was upset because of that. Maybe he was upset because God was merciful. That's not clear. But was it morally wicked? And down here, the disaster is, this is the wickedness. Because Jonah says, I knew that you were a God who forgives wickedness. And down, and finally, the last one in 4:6 is, it says, it went up over, the kikayon, whatever the plant was, went up over his head to shade him and to rescue him from his wickedness, his sinfulness, his evilness? That doesn't make sense. The meaning of a word, even the same word in this, I mean, Jonah is one of the shortest books in the Bible, 48 verses. Even in the same book, even in the same context, varies tremendously. And the translator and the translation committee, the publisher, makes a decision up front, are we going to make this word sound the same all the time so that you, the English reader who doesn't know Hebrew and can't look at it, knows that it's the same word? Because this is obviously a theme in Jonah. How important is it for your understanding of Jonah to know that the same word comes up in all those verses? Some people will say, oh, it's very important. But even in a translation like the New King James or the NASB, the two probably most literal translations that are around, it's not the same way in all those.
Because the translator, the committee, all those steps up to the English stylist, they have to make those decisions about how are we going to do this? What are we going to do? What are we going to do with this word? Well, I wanted to talk about this famous verse, but I think I'm out of time. I'll just put that up there and let you puzzle over it for a while. Leave that up there. Maybe you can ask some questions. Tried to say that we have language as a gift from God that is, like all of his gifts, a good thing. But whenever we do anything with language, we're translating. And that all translation is approximate or metaphorical. Replication, perfect equivalence, is impossible. We can't do it. And all translation is conditioned by a host of factors, including our education, our theological bent, our culture that we grew up in, our relationship with our parents, and if God is called a father, you know, that's part of it, is conditioned by a host of things, most of which we're unaware of. So in conclusion, my counsel is, I know you didn't come asking for counsel, but I'm going to offer it anyway, don't run after the newest translation. Remember that whatever translation you read, it's a translation. And so arguments like, my version is best because, really are pretty meaningless in the long run. It is possible for them to be right or wrong, like the Wicked Bible of, what was it, 1605 or something, that translated the commandment, thou shalt commit adultery. That was actually a problem with the printers, but they were sent to prison, fined £3,000 for that. But actually, what would help you the most, what would help the most, I think, besides studying Greek and Hebrew, and I'm serious about that, make it a nice hobby, is to read a book or two about how language works. And to read the Bible as though it were a book. Just like you'd read a book. So you start at the beginning of Joshua and read Joshua. Rather than puzzle over Joshua 1, read Joshua 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. But if you think about all that's entailed, I think you'd probably conclude, as I have concluded many times, that I'm thankful to God that the people have translated the Bible. I've done that for a long time, so that I could have it before I read Greek and Hebrew, and so that we can have it in ways that we can understand it. So thanks. Are there any questions?